Jesus predicts his death a second time. They left that place and passed through Galilee. Jesus did not want anyone to know where they were, because he was teaching his disciples. He said to them, "The Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men. They will kill him, and after 3 days he will rise." But they did not understand what he meant, and were afraid to ask him about it. They came to Capernaum. When he was in the house, he asked them, "What were you arguing about on the road?" But they kept quiet, because on the way they had argued about who was the greatest. Sitting down, Jesus called the 12 and said, "Anyone who wants to be first must be the very last and the servant of all." He took a little child, whom he placed among them. Taking the child in his arms, he said to them, "Whoever welcomes one of these little children in my name welcomes me, and whoever welcomes me does not welcome me, but the one who sent me."
"Teacher," said John, "we saw someone driving out demons in your name, and we told him to stop because he was not one of us." "Do not stop him," Jesus said, "for no one who does a miracle in my name can in the next moment say anything bad about me. For whoever is not against us is for us. Truly I tell you, anyone who gives you a cup of water in my name because you belong to the Messiah will certainly not lose their reward. If anyone causes one of these little ones, those who believe in me, to stumble, it would be better for them if a large millstone were hung around their neck and they were thrown into the sea. If your hand causes you to stumble, cut it off. It is better for you to enter life maimed than with two hands to go into hell, where the fire never goes out. And if your foot causes you to stumble, cut it off. It is better for you to enter life crippled than to have two feet and be thrown into hell. And if your eye causes you to stumble, pluck it out. It is better for you to enter the kingdom of God with one eye than to have two eyes and be thrown into hell, where the worms that eat them do not die and the fire is not quenched. Everyone will be salted with fire. Salt is good, but if it loses its saltiness, how can you make it salty again? Have salt among yourselves and be at peace with each other."
I acknowledge that I stand on Whadjuk Noongar land to speak this morning, and acknowledge the elders who come before and who will come after. The reading this morning is the lectionary reading for today. It's actually the lectionary reading for 2 weeks, but it felt to me that they went together. Commentators often say this is a bunch of kind of disparate teachings all put in place, but I actually think they're a linked piece to do with this theme of servanthood and self-sacrificing discipleship and inclusion. The overriding question I would like you to sit with, and whether you listen to me or not, is how can these words that we've heard read help us to love each other well? How can these words help us to manifest God in the communities we're in through the week? And how can these words help us to recognise Christ amongst us? And that might be all you need for today. Just sit with that, or you can listen to me, that's fine. So where this is about halfway through Mark's Gospel. It's a couple of chapters that are between the Transfiguration and Jesus' entry into Jerusalem. So we're on the road, and Jesus has just appeared to them on the mountain in shining robes with Moses and Elijah. And then he here in this passage tells them that he's going to die and be raised to life. Now, despite the fact that they've just seen him with Moses and Elijah, they don't seem to have heard the bit about and be raised to life. They just hear the bit about him going to be dying. And it freaks them right out. Last time he mentioned this, a few verses earlier on, that he was going to die, Peter objected and he got his head completely bitten off. So this time, unsurprisingly, they say nothing and are afraid to answer any questions, to ask questions. And then they had this conversation on the road, and mostly it's assumed that they were talking about who was the greatest. Mostly that's assumed that they're putting themselves forward about how great they are. "I'm much better than you." And so Jesus brings a child and puts it among them and says, this is where the kingdom is to be found, in being like a child, in welcoming like a child. The Aramaic word for child is the same word as servant. It's this one word. The text we've got is Greek, but Jesus was an Aramaic speaker. So although we have a word that specifically means child, Jesus very likely used a word that means both child and servant. So he's making that thing. A child in this culture, a child in Greco-Roman culture was virtually a non-person in the social hierarchy. In the Jewish culture, they weren't quite as invisible as that. But very importantly, in Jewish culture, children were outside of the law. They hadn't reached an age of accountability, so they were not accountable to the law, but they also weren't able to be saved by the law. They were outside that system. So Jesus, for his model of discipleship, reaches to someone at the very bottom of the social hierarchy and outside the religious hierarchy, and says, this is where we need to look. Now, it does make sense that the disciples have been very arrogant pushing themselves forward, and Jesus responds with this critique. But I also want to put forward a couple of what-ifs, because it says they're arguing about who's the greatest. Now, if they have just heard Jesus say that he's going to die, and most commentators look at that and go, well, they just weren't tuned in at all, that they then started arguing about greatness. But what if they actually took seriously that he was about to die? The very next task they need to do is find a new leader. So they are now discussing which one of us is the appropriate person to take on this role if he's going to die. And Jesus perhaps is not telling them off, but giving them wise advice. Okay, you're going to get to a point when you need a new leader, and how are you going to choose that leader? Look for the one who welcomes little children as if they were welcoming me. Who welcomes everyone, who welcomes the least, the lost, the littlest, as if welcoming Christ's self. Don't look for your next leader with the person who's the greatest. Or another what if is, what if they're arguing about who's the greatest, but they're not putting themselves forward, they're putting someone else forward. So imagine that we at Mount Hawthorn had an argument about who is the greatest in this community. I imagine it would go something like this. I think Peter's the greatest because he is able to get people thinking about Jesus and the way of Jesus in just an accessible, open way. Now, Peter's looking uncomfortable just having me say this, and Peter would immediately say, no, I'm not the greatest. I think Malin's the greatest because Malin has this compassionate pastoral presence and ability to be alongside people. And Malin would say, no, I'm not the greatest. Absolutely not. Bobby is the greatest. Bobby has an incredible intellect but comes every Sunday and puts the chairs out without drawing attention to herself. And Bobby would point to someone else and someone else. Perhaps this is the argument they were having on the road about who is the greatest, but not themselves. So why would Jesus tell them off?
Is there any other word for greatest? Like, is that a...
I'm not sure. I'm not sure what the Greek word is under there, and I'm not sure the breadth of what it could mean. Thank you. So if Jesus then critiques them for having that conversation, what's the problem? I think it's that the problem is not whether you're climbing up or down a ladder. The problem is thinking about people in terms of ranking and hierarchy and greatness. It is just as problematic to see yourself as inferior to others as to see yourself as greater than them. And yet we humans do this all the time. We think about people in a kind of internal, instinctive ranking way. Jesus' advice then, when he says, if you want to be the greatest, make yourself the least, the last, it's not actually advice for how to achieve greatness. It's an invitation into the futility of working around a system of hierarchy in community. Because if your aim is to be the greatest and so you need to be the least, then when you get there, you're now the greatest. But now you've failed because now you wanted to be the least so you could be the greatest. It's an endless, impossible cycle of doing that. Jesus is not setting up a new race to be the most servant-like. Jesus is saying this idea of hierarchy and ranking is against the way that I operate. He's putting a spanner into the wheel of the whole system of competing against each other in any form. I recognise the irony of saying this on a day that my son chose to come to church wearing a whole lot of medals. So I would like us to take a moment to pay attention in ourselves to the way we do this. And I suspect we all do this. I know I do. At church, in our families, in workplaces, in social situations, do we instinctively walk into a room and get a measure of where we fit? Who do we feel a little bit, that person there, I walk in and I think, I'm probably smarter than them, but I'm not as beautiful as them, and they are way more athletic than me, and they've got a lot more social capital than I have. I'm not as connected here. Or all of those things and ways of assessing, where's our peg in this room, in this community, in this workplace? I think this text is deliberately undercutting that whole way of thinking. Imagine one of the settings you spend a lot of time in, and just get a sense of where you rank yourself instinctively in that place. And imagine seeing everyone there as no more important than you and no less important than you. And then our text goes on in verse 38, and this problem of hierarchies continues. How are the disciples going to rank somebody who does good works but is not explicitly a follower of Jesus? And the translation is often, the exorcist, he was casting out demons in your name, but he's not one of us. But the actual wording is that he is not following us. He's not in his appropriate place in the line. What if he gets some benefit for being in front of us that we should get? And Jesus says, if he's not for us, if he's not against us, he's for us. Which seems to, look, just let him do what he does. You do not need to sort out his relative value. Which is when we get to the really forceful language. It would be better if. It would be better if you were drowned with a huge grinding stone round your neck, the sort that only a donkey can pull. It would be better if you lopped off your hand, if you hacked off your leg, if you gouged out your eye. Better than what? It would be better to be dead or to be delimbed than to cause a little one to stumble. And who is the little one? Each one of you, each one of us. So the millstone image about not causing someone else to stumble and the eye, hand, foot image about not causing yourself to stumble are really an overlapping. Don't cause a little one to stumble, whether that's yourself or someone else. And what does this mean, to stumble? The Greek word skandalizo, to stumble, means something like to stick a trip hazard in someone's way, or to bait a trap, or to tie their fingers together with sticky tape, or put a blindfold on them, or put a mitt on their hand. If you're listening to the tape at home, I just realised that sounds really strange, but we had a beautiful object lesson with the children before this talk, and that makes sense in that context. So in the context of Jesus talking about the death and resurrection as his way, this child-based object lesson that the community has no ranking to greater or lesser, what are the trip hazards or the baits that are in the way? Maybe they are ideas of greatness is a trip hazard. A culture of hierarchy is a bait in a trap. Personal ambition. Jesus says it's better to be drowned or cut to pieces than to be caught up in those power games. That is how seriously Jesus takes the business of absolute equality without hierarchy amongst his followers. We don't like this idea. Well, we kind of like the idea, but we don't actually do it very well. And I think our aversion to reading this and hearing this is reflected in how many people thinking about this text find in it references to sexual sin. That they would, particularly because the word foot is often used euphemistically for penis in the Bible. But the idea that if you mention a body part, hand, foot, that you must be talking about sex and it must be bad. We would rather moralise about sex. I'll just give you a minute to just work with that idea of... I can see everyone going, foot, penis, penis, foot, penis. Yeah, look, never mind, you know, how beautiful are the feet of the messengers of the good news. But but it's a commonly used, it's not every time they say foot it means penis, but it's commonly used because they don't want to say penis, and I can see people in this room don't want to either. Thank you for the red faces everywhere. That they say foot instead. So, for example, in Ruth, when Ruth is seducing Boaz, isn't it, the very good upright man, and she lies down at his feet. She possibly wasn't lying at his feet. So, anyway. So for that little piece of biblical knowledge you've now got, just let that settle and I'll go on with what I was actually going to say. And you can all stop looking at your feet. She was a lovely, good woman. She didn't do anything wrong, but she probably didn't lie down at the end of his bed. Okay, I'm not going to talk any more about Boaz, okay? You are proving my point that we would rather moralise about sex or talk about it or joke about it than face our church cultures of hierarchy. We would rather not face our inner desire for power. And that is both our desire to have our own power or control, but it's also when we feel powerless, our desire to have someone in power and control who can help us. To be able to say, well, I'm a poor, worthless nothing, but thank goodness there's someone higher up the ladder who is in a role to help me here. There's nobody higher up the ladder. We are all together. And Jesus uses images that are things that have been created for a good, proper purpose. Your hand, your eye, your foot, your penis, if that's what you're thinking of. The problem is not what they are, it's that they're not fulfilling their purpose. And if they don't do what they're created to do, then they are not worth having. I think this is what cut it off means. If it's not doing what it's made to do, it's not doing anything good. Like salt that is no longer salty, which is the image at the end of the passage. What is the proper created task for the things that might cause stumbling? Eyes, for example. Eyes are not just created to see. Our eyes are created to see with love, to see injustice. Our eyes are created to motivate our hands and our feet to then move, to be present to that injustice, to make a difference. Our feet are for carrying us on the road with Jesus. Our feet are for standing up against oppression. Our hands are for healing and nurturing, for building and shielding. But when our eyes are used to plot victory, when our hands are used to grasp things for ourselves, when our feet are used to climb over other people to get ahead, we would be better off without them. They're not doing what their purpose is. And so the passage gets to some very vivid imagery about hell, which here in this passage is literally, the word is Gehenna, the valley of Hinnom, which is the garbage dump outside Jerusalem, which before it was a garbage dump was a place of child sacrifice. Gehenna is a valley outside Jerusalem. It had a good created purpose. It is part of God's good earth. And human beings turned it into a place of exclusion and torment. Human beings created hell, created Gehenna in a good valley. Just like an eye that was created to see love but only sees roads to power, Gehenna should have been a fertile valley full of farmers, and it became a place of torture and torment. Now, people talking about this passage almost universally, with a few very scary exceptions, are happy to say that Jesus does not literally mean cut your eye out, chop your hand off. That Jesus doesn't literally mean that. He's using extreme language to make a point. But in the same breath, they will say, but when it gets to Gehenna, then it's literal. Actually, Jesus is saying God will literally put you into a fiery place forever where the worm never dies. I don't think so. I think this whole passage is using extreme hyperbolic language to demonstrate just how seriously Jesus takes this idea that his community is a servant community with no hierarchy and an absolute welcome. Gehenna here is equated with this idea of living with rankings, living in structures of power as value systems. And he says it's better to cut your hand off than live like that. Better to this than Gehenna. Gehenna is a word. He's calling that way of living by hierarchies hell. A place where the worm never dies. Isn't that an image that seems to describe systems of power above people? A worm that never dies. So what's that bit that we get to about being salted with fire? Nobody knows. Nobody really knows what that means. It's probably something to do with suffering and persecution coming. Somehow the consequences of challenging power structures will probably burn like anything. But that is what will give the disciples their flavour and their effectiveness. That's what will purify and strengthen them. Salt's usually talked about in terms of its flavouring and in terms of being a preservative. I always have to be really conscious that salt is a good term in the Bible because I live in Western Australia and salt here is ruining the wheat belt. And when I think of salt, I think of degraded farmland. So I have to be really conscious that that's not what is happening here. Salt is a good thing. There's another image around salt which is from Jesus' time, which is often not picked up here, which is that at the time it was common practice to salt newborn babies, to rub them all over, naked little babies in salt. Apparently this is still a practice in some parts of the world. But it's mentioned in the Bible in Ezekiel. It's clearly a thing that was current at the time. Jesus has just emphasised to his children that they're to be like little children. And I think the salt imagery is possibly picking that up, taking them right back to being helpless infants. Newborn and salted is a phrase from Annie Dillard. And to say that they're salted with fire suggests that they're helpless and vulnerable, but they're being given a protection and a blessing, probably one that they don't understand and might not even like. I imagine rubbing salt on a tiny baby is not going to have them smiling at you. Maybe it feels lovely. I don't know. I've never tried rubbing salt on a tiny baby. Or possibly the reference to salt is a poetic way of saying that we're going to be washed in tears, the salty, painful tears that will be over us like a fire. Because Jesus never suggests that following him will be comfortable. And finally, it says, be salted and be at peace with one another. Here we've circled back to the disciples' conflict on the road. Their attempts to rank each other had them in conflict. But sharing this uneasy salting of Jesus, the entry into the life of death and resurrection, this will set them at peace with one another. Now, this is probably not new to anyone. We've spent years in churches, those of you who I know well here, you've spent years and years in churches having people tell you that following Jesus is about a servant-type life. Is that true? So the question really is not what does this mean, but what are we going to do about it? What is God saying to you today through this text? When I sat with this text through the week coming in, the thing that kept rising up for me was this idea of stumbling blocks. What is it that hampers me, that gets in my way when I desire to follow Jesus in this way of complete equality? What gets in my way? And there's a fear in me. There's a fear that is a block. And if I'm really honest with me, there's some sort of fear that I can't quite put words to, that if I don't rank myself against other people, I won't know who I am. Maybe I'll be worthless. Maybe no one else will see that I have any value. That's for me. That's something that I've discovered others that's sitting there. What is it for you? What gets between you and walking this servant path of Jesus? Perhaps it's fear. Perhaps there's some sort of an ego, ambition. Perhaps it's a low self-image, an inability to see yourself as equal to others and of value. Perhaps there's memories. Perhaps there's a particular image of God that stands in your way. Or grief. other people's opinions. Perhaps a desire to make sure community never fights is a desire for community harmony gets in the way of you. Or maybe it's really concrete things like your current job or my low level of physical fitness or the possessions that I hold dear or that I haven't spent enough time with someone who renews my soul. What is it that gets in the way at the moment? The images Jesus used were all good things with a created positive purpose that weren't fulfilling that purpose. And the obstacles in your path will very likely have a good created purpose. Fear keeps us safe from actual genuine danger. Grief is absolutely essential to give our losses voice and honour them. But if these things become obstacles, obstacles to following Jesus away from hierarchies of power, then they're not fulfilling their created purpose anymore. What to do? There are so many obstacles. Three things occurred to me, and I don't like to give advice, so these are ideas. What to do in response, and they're talking to myself as much as anyone else. You, use your own name. You are the little one, the vulnerable one, who is unable to climb to power. You are the one who Jesus welcomes, just as you are. Start there, I would say. Obstacles, if they are seen clearly, don't have to be obstacles. It's a cliche to say an obstacle can become a stepping stone, but it is sometimes true. But also, obstacles seen clearly can be very carefully detoured around or, you know, effectively blown up with dynamite if you're watching properly. Obstacles don't have to stay obstacles if we are clear-sighted. And finally, that walking through an obstacle course is a lot easier if you're not doing it alone. We are together the ones who assaulted with Jesus. We're not assaulted. We are assaulted with Jesus' challenging mission. We're together called to be at peace. Because it is the togethering that makes it possible. As the children demonstrated really beautifully, if they had been more helpful, the task would have been easier. If they'd held that bit of paper still, the cutting with the scissors would have just gone so much smoother. Hierarchies separate. But Jesus' way is to come together. And Jesus' way is almost guaranteed to bring suffering. Because it challenges the very fabric of how our world operates. But it is the way of peace when we walk it together. It's the way of death and resurrection. It might feel like we're walking into death, but it is the way that promises new life. We are the little ones of God. None of us is more important. None of us is less significant than any other. And we are on this bumpy road of Jesus, the bumpy road of death and resurrection. We are on that road together. Does anyone want to make any questions or comments in that?
Thank you, Claire. That made a lot of sense of what initially was a very confusing passage. It reminds me of an article I saw yesterday in the magazine in the West Australian on Park Life, where they're talking about a game called Park Life, and you've got two teams and they have to build a park, and the best park wins the competition. But the comment was that instead of focusing on building a good park, each team was looking at how they could pull down the other team's park.
Mm.
It was referred to as trashing your neighbour's park. And then it went on to talk about how human beings have got a tendency to, instead of looking after making their own patch good, have a tendency to trash other people's park, and then went on to explain what it meant in other ways rather than just trashing the park. It was sort of criticising other people or whatever. And I thought it was actually quite a powerful message, and it really ties in quite well with what you were saying. So I'd suggest if anyone's got the West, have a look in the Play magazine and have a look at that article.
Thanks, Tricia.
I'd just like to wheel this suitcase in here. The start of the second passage, where it's starting to talk about anyone that causes this child to stumble, blah, 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 and you are better to cut it off, you're better to do. How does that work as advice within a community? Isn't that saying if someone within the community is causing you to stumble, you should exclude them?
It's certainly been taken that way. Yeah, it has been a text used to justify excommunication. And I would say that it's the whole passage is framed as us doing this together. How do we as disciples, followers of Jesus, live life together? So I don't think, just as it's not literally meaning cut your hand off, I don't think it's literally meaning cut that person off. I think it's saying if something is not living out its created purpose, then work with that until it is living out its created purpose. If there's a human being in your midst who is becoming a hindrance to the faith of the community, then something about the way they're living, or something about the way the community is living, is not living out God's created being. Work with that.
Yeah, I suppose the language in there is quite specific, I suppose, in the fact that it's remove it, not make it better.
Yeah, it is. I think it's saying remove its way of being that it is doing now, rather than its created self. Yeah.
I just wanted to say something about social comparisons, and it's a little hard to put my thoughts together on a Sunday morning, but I was, so when you were talking about the greatest and then thinking about, do we walk into a room and think I'm smarter than this person and more beautiful, less beautiful and that sort of thing. And it brought to mind Eden's wonderful announcement this morning, and the thing that I loved the very best about that was his face and that sense of being proud of himself and that he had won this most valuable player. And so I've got two thoughts, and one is thinking about body of Christ in that sense that we all have a role to play, and our hands are better at things like writing and our feet are better at things like walking, and that's all part of a community. But where am I going with this? So social comparisons are a normal part of being human, with a really long history explaining why we are made that way. So I see that as an inevitable part of being human, that we will think I'm better at this than you are, and vice versa. But I don't think me being better at this thing than this other person means that I'm greater. It means that we all have our strengths.
Yeah. Thank you. You articulated that very well.
Just to address Ian's point, my decades have led me to the conclusion that it's not a good idea to take one passage from Scripture and say, there you are, that's what it says. When you find a passage of Scripture and you think, well, maybe that means that, then you need to look at all the other things that Jesus said and look at the whole. There are consistent messages right from Genesis through the Bible. There aren't very many of them, and they're mainly to do with justice and love, and that's, I think, where we need to stick with that. But I was just thinking with this guy who was driving out demons in Jesus' name, without giving a 15-minute speech on what that actually means, this is a warning for us, I think, particularly about denominationalism and criticising other Christians, and saying they're the ones who've got it wrong, because very often the people who you regard as your biggest enemy are those who are closest to you. And Jesus wants us to be one. And it's not for us to say that this group or that group are not one of us. You know, they're not us. But there's so much of the church does that. You know, those people out there, not us sensible people here, but those people out there who criticise each other, what awful people they are.
Yes. Oh, one from Jenny, and then that'd be the end.
There's a really helpful word used quite a lot in educational circles, which is the word mastery. And I think it's a fantastic word to break the conflict we might feel between not thinking too highly of ourselves but wanting to be good at things. And developing mastery is a wonderful sense of achievement, and I think it's, you know, to know that something went well or you did it, you put in the effort and you got a good result, is not being proud in a bad way. So mastery is so important. But the great thing about mastery is that you can help other people achieve it. And so you see the potential in other people. And you know, if you know what that feels like for yourself, you want it for other people. So Eden's allowed to have mastery with his medals.
Thank you, Jenny. Thanks, everyone, for your input. Appreciate it.